IsraelSin.com.
Sitting here with a fellow named Izzy, whose last name I won't even try and pronounce. Izzy, could you help me with that?
Pludwinski.
Thank you. I met you, in a sense, from an article in the Jerusalem Post a little while back that talked about your artwork on the occasion of the exhibit that you have here in the Yakar Center in West Jerusalem. And I, if I'm not mistaken, it mentioned that you came here originally not as an artist.
Came to Israel? I came to Israel as I was a chemistry teacher at the time in high school. And circumstances in my life caused me at one point to need a big change in my life. It happened actually when I took a course in Bnei Brak for Sofrim. And
scribes,
right, religious scribes. And once I had that quill in hand, I knew that was it. I wasn't going to be looking back.
When we first talked, you mentioned that the article contained various inaccuracies and elements that you were not too satisfied with. So here's an opportunity to set the record straight. One of the things I think you mentioned that disturbed you was the way it described or explained your relationship to some of the rabbinic figures that you find inspiring.
There's always been this parallel between, I've been very fortunate in that sense, there's been this parallel between my, call it spiritual religious interest or development on the one hand, and my calligraphy, or the calligraphy on the other hand. Whereas in the beginning, I had this fascination with the Hebrew letter, the Torah script, and all the mystical secrets that were hidden in each tiny detail of each letter. And I remember standing in the back of a shul one day, and there was this enlarged picture of the letter Yud, and it pointed to the oketz of the Yud, which is this little thorn-like protrusion on this small letter, and it said if an entire Sefer Torah was written correctly, but one Yud was missing that little oketz, then the entire Sefer Torah was pasul. And I was thinking, wow, what mystical secrets are locked in that oketz? So it was always sort of in the back of my mind, this thing. And then when that opportunity came for a career change, so that sort of locked in. And that's what drew me to study to be a Sofer Stam. And I worked in that for quite a few years. Then later on, I became exposed to the wider world of calligraphy. And I saw what calligraphers were doing with words and with texts. They were doing these fantastic, creative, artistic things that really moved me. But at the same time, I was also exposed to a different, in my Torah studies, I was also introduced to a different way of learning, a different approach to learning, which was very healthy for me. It renewed my understanding of the need for learning. And I was also exposed to new texts that I was not exposed to in my traditional yeshiva background and yeshiva education. And I wanted to take these texts out of the books and, you know, show the world. I wanted to express them artistically and calligraphically. So that worked beautifully with that exposure to seeing what's going on in the calligraphy world. And actually, after a while, went to London to study this formally. And I did that for quite a few years, working as a freelance calligrapher. And then came another stage where I had this, I would call it a crisis with texts in general. A sort of losing of confidence in the ability of the study of texts, the intellectual study of texts, to deeply affect the personality and soul of a person. The example I usually give is you can be sitting in the Beit Midrash in the yeshiva.
In the study hall,
and for example, come across a text as written in the Talmud in Tractate Ta'anit, where it says, "Le'olam yehe adam rach kekaneh, ve'al yehe kasheh ke'erez." A man should always be as soft as a reed, and never as unyielding as the cedar. So you're sitting there and you're studying it, and you say, "Well, that's a nice text, you know." The Gemara says I should always be like that. Okay, so I'll take it on. I'll try to be that. And you can even fool yourself into thinking, okay, I'm a cool guy, you know, I'm not going to get angry, I'll just be as it says. And of course, you're waiting in line in the post office, in the bank, and someone cuts in front of you, and you know, right away you become hard as a cedar. So the way I see that is that the learning just sort of stays from the neck upwards. It didn't really enter your bones, your kishkas. This, you know, you have an idea of being soft and unyielding, but the truth is, but the truth is, it's just an idea that didn't really affect you deeply. Now, at the same time, I was studying Tai Chi. And there's a part in Tai Chi where you work with a partner. It's called push hands. And you're standing there. Your partner is opposite you. And with gentle movements, you're trying to find his center of balance to try to push him off. At the same time, he's doing the same thing to you. Now, the instinctual response, if someone's putting his hand on you to try to push you over, is you become hard, you become tough. You say, "You're not going to push me over." But the paradox is, the second you become hard there, it's very easy to push you off. And the whole learning is to how to become really soft and yielding deep in, completely. Your mind, your bones, your kishkes, you have to be soft. And what happens then is if you're soft when he puts your hand, then he loses his balance and it's very easy to push him off. So there I felt was this holistic way approach to learning was a way of instilling the same Talmudic dictum of to be soft as a reed, but it was instilling it in a very deeper way that didn't stop just at the head and back. So I was excited more by these holistic ways of learning. And I was disillusioned with texts and learning. A calligrapher without a text is a problem. What does he write? You know, what does he do? So that's when I found that my focus started to change from the what I'm writing, from the content of the texts to how I'm writing, from the what to the how. And I started to look inwards in my I started to look inwards to see how I am writing. Can I instill the same soft as a reed ideal in the actual act of writing? Can I write without tension? Can I write being attentive to my breath? Can I be soft as a reed, really, during the act of writing, this sort of moving meditation, with the belief that somehow if I can do this, then somehow this would be reflected in the actual marks on the paper. This doesn't happen in a vacuum, this change. I've always been attracted to the Japanese arts. In the beginning, because of the aesthetics of it, I just was very moved by Japanese calligraphy and Japanese art. Not only Japanese, Chinese art, I mean the Far East. And afterwards, the thinking behind the arts. You might know that many of the Japanese arts have the word do in it. There's judo, aikido, kendo is the art of the sword, and calligraphy in Japanese is shodo. Do means way, and they're referring to a way of living. Because when you study a Japanese art, these do arts, you don't only learn the techniques of the actual techniques of the art, but you're also learning, and maybe maybe you're mainly learning about yourself. You know, there's a book called Zen and the Art of Archery, and the way they describe it then is that the target is not the external target, but you are the target. And if you're able to hit that target, the center of yourself, then really the rest becomes easy. Now, what does this mean about hitting yourself? I think in this whole process, this whole inward process of learning about yourself or paying attention to yourself during the actual act of the art, you meet your ego. You come in contact with your ego, which, let's just call it for now, all the external parts of the personality, the parts that the masks we put on, the ambitions, the aspirations, the what I'm supposed to be doing. And if you're somehow able to go past this, break this obstacle, you meet, or what they say you meet, is your authentic self. And then when you can bring this authentic to yourself into any sort of meet encounter, right? And it doesn't matter if it's an encounter with the divine or with a fellow human being or the brush. What happens if you manage to bring this pure self into this encounter, then paradoxically the self, here comes the hard, I don't know really what the word to use. The word that's very often used, which I find problematic, is the word nullified. The self isn't there, but it's not as if the self doesn't exist. It's just that there's no separation between the self and what it's mean. There's no difference between subject and object. When this happens in shodo, in calligraphy, they say that the person and the brush become one, and maybe even taken further, the brush and the ink and the paper become one. It's just the act of a pure act of writing. I think I have to introduce another concept, and that's the concept of qi, qi is in Chinese, in Hebrew, in Japanese it's ki, which is usually defined as some universal energy, the energy of the cosmos. And the belief is if you can have this pure encounter, then the qi sort of flows through you. And this energy, it flows through you into the brush, through the ink, onto the paper, and this can somehow be felt by the viewer. And this is really what differentiates Zen calligraphy from any other type of calligraphy. Because Zen calligraphy isn't that concerned with beautiful letters or aesthetic letters. It in some sense couldn't care less. It deeply cares about an expression of pure mind, of pure self, and this flow of qi. And when you appreciate a piece of Zen calligraphy, it's this qi that supposedly jumps out at you and affects you. Okay, but enough about Zen. You asked about Hasidut.
I was just about to say, but it's such a wonderful explanation you're giving. I understand where you can feel that you're not the most articulate person on the block, but what you have to say really, you say it well, and I appreciate it. So I wasn't going to stop you, but I was going to sooner or later ask, and how does that connect to Judaism? Where is any of this to be found in Judaism, or have you found any of these elements in Judaism?
I certainly deeply believe that anything that is found here is found in Judaism. I think it's less explicitly expressed, certainly as far as calligraphy, even though there are many, many texts and disciplines about kavanot for the sofer when he writes. So this certainly exists there, but we just get back to the Zen part, because I always said there's this parallel between the calligraphic learning and the religious learning. So I'm continuing along with my learning, but now I'm being exposed to more Hasidic texts. And much to my surprise, I'm finding the same concepts that I came across in my Zen readings. I found very similar sounding concepts in these Hasidic writings. Now, I don't know enough to say that they're identical, and certainly Zen and Hasidut are two worlds apart. But when I come across a Hasidic text that's talking about the importance of bitul atzmi, which is a nullification of the self, or transparency of the self, and that one of the effects of this bitul atzmi is that you become a vessel, a kli, for some divine energy, some divine sparks to flow through you as an ideal, that just resonates with the same thing that's happening in Zen. There's also another aspect that's not strictly Hasidut, but in other words, when I'm trying to think, well, does Judaism really have room for other types of connections with the divine, you know, other than prayer, learning, specifically defined mitzvot? I was very happy when I came across a commentary by Rav Kook on B'chol Drachecha De'ehu, on through all your ways you should know him. And what Rav Kook says, he starts off also with prayer and with learning, but he says, really, in essence, in any act that you do, B'chol Drachecha, each act that you do, that is where God is found. And, well, I think it's certainly a religious goal. And one of the reasons I enjoy the work that I do is because I don't like these dichotomies that we sort of set up for ourselves. Here is my spiritual life, here is my work, here is my family life. I really do believe that each act that we do is an opportunity for, I'm using words that I think are problematic, but for a religious act, for a spiritual development, a spiritual awareness, spiritual growth. And so therefore I find, not consolation, but I find support or reinforcement in these words of Rav Kook, where he's saying that really in every act that you do. And I think that that's important because in calligraphy, I went to Japan to participate in a Zen calligraphy workshop. And I really didn't go there in order to learn calligraphy. Because even though there's a lot to learn from Japanese calligraphy, that's, you know, my heart is in Hebrew letters, and I certainly wasn't going to Japan to study Hebrew. But I kept on telling people, I'm not really going to learn calligraphy, I'm learning how to wash dishes. And meaning that I really want to bring this into my life. Calligraphy is just a specific example. It's an example that I love and that I spend a lot of time doing it, but it's a way to incorporate everything, every single act, in order to understand how to bring every act, every simple act into my life to be a possibility for growth.
You're talking about the possibility of having a divine experience or having a transcendent experience.
Yes, but I don't really know.
I hear you're not satisfied with that frame that you actually said about growth. That seemed to be not the word you really wanted, or not the concept that quite fit.
Finding the right words is always a problem for me. And the word transcendent, could be a good description, but I don't want it to sound like otherworldly, something that's taken me out of everyday experience. I'm looking for ways to bring, and again, I'm using the word God, but God has brings such stereotypic images, and of course images are the one thing you're not supposed to do with God. But some type of deeper way of living. And I don't want this dichotomy of spirit, using the word spiritual growth as opposed to what? As opposed to... So that's why I was very hesitant with my words. But it's something that has to be experienced. It doesn't fit into neat, or at least I'm not able to express it in simple words.
Just to sort of... kind of conclude this element in the conversation. Are there other rabbinic statements or statements by other rabbis or philosophies that you've encountered? Again, Simcha Bunim was the only one that was. I think they mentioned Rav Kook, but Simcha Bunim seemed to be the main character. But I noticed in one of your paintings it was related to Kotsk. I don't remember his first name. The rabbi Menachem Mendel of Kotsk. So you've read through some of this work. Are there others that stand out in their in the appropriateness of what they're saying to the ideas that you're pursuing?
Okay. First, I want to you mentioned in the beginning that there were some inaccuracies with the article. So I want to, one of them had to do with Pishischa Chassidut. The things I had mentioned before about bitul atzmi, nullification of the self, and the allowing yourself, trying to become a vessel for some divine flow to pass through you, that is not, it does not seem to be a central feature of Bishischa Chassidut at all. I mean, I'm sure it's found a lot of Chassidut. I find it a lot in the Sfat Emet. Bishischa Chassidut doesn't really deal with, or doesn't emphasize Kabbalistic terminology. They don't use Kabbalistic terminology. When I had mentioned Bishischa Chassidut in the article, it was about this deep demand for authenticity. So the part about reaching an authentic self, that resonates within deeply in Bishischa Chassidut. Kutsk is a Menachem Mendel of Kutsk was a took over for Reb Subcha ben of Bishischa and followed the same lines of thinking. So he didn't really deviate at all. Kutsk, I wouldn't say Kutsk Chassidut is different than Bishischa Chassidut. It's one of three Hasidic masters. It started with the Yehudi HaKadosh, then Reb Simcha Bunim took over, and then Menachem Mendel of Kutz took over. Menachem, with slightly different emphases. Menachem Mendel of Kutz was very radical in his in this search for truth and not putting on any religious airs whatsoever. His famous statement is Lo tignov me'atzmecha. I mean, don't steal from yourself. Don't. That's how and that's what attracted me to the Menachem Mendel of Kutsk, who had very sharp aphorisms. Is that the word? And very attractive to a calligrapher to want to express them.
The other element, which I don't think we've really mentioned, is your artistic ability and sensitivity. I mean, were you it doesn't sound like you had specifically artistic training, but it's very highly developed in your work. Is that just something that flows from you?
It doesn't flow easily. I put a lot of hard work into it. My calligraphic training, for the most part, was my original training as a sofer. I had a wonderful teacher. As I had mentioned earlier, at some point, I had gone to London to study calligraphy full-time for 2 years. Actually, that's how I first met Rabbi Mickey Rosen of Yakar, because that's where Yakar started in London. I've attended workshops. I'm heavily involved in the calligraphy world, both here and in Chutz La'aretz, and I've attended workshops, and I did study Japanese calligraphy because once I had moved over to the brush, see, that's one thing about, that's why I think one of the things that attracted me to try this form of brush calligraphy, well, two things actually brought me to that. First was the once I was exposed to calligraphy in the wider world after being a sofer, I felt that there was this big gap in forms of expression. Hebrew calligrapher basically studies a few square scripts. And paleographically, it's called the Hebrew square script. And I was seeing what was happening in English calligraphy, Latin calligraphy, just very creative, expressive, daring changing of form. And then I compared that to what I was doing as a Hebrew calligrapher. It was just basically writing the square Hebrew letter with slight variations, but it certainly didn't lend itself to such a wide variety of expression. And whether you're dealing with expressive texts or you're just trying to express some emotion in yourself, you need a repertoire. So I started a very, very long series of just experimentations, just play, really. Just letting myself go, not just seeing where my hand wanted to take me, not being that concerned with legibility. And little by little, I developed this, what I would call an abstract Hebrew alphabet, a very personal alphabet, just developing my own visual language for expression. Now, once I became interested in the more Zen type approach to calligraphy, where I was using it as a tool for some expression of what's going on inside of me, then the sumi brush seemed to be the natural tool for doing that, because the sumi brush is a very, very sensitive tool. Any slight hesitancy, any unsuredness, any tension that you have inside will come out in the line, as opposed to, let's say, a hard quill or a metal nib, which most traditional Western calligraphy is written with. The sumi brush, as I said, is a very, very sensitive tool, and that's why I started doing this brush calligraphy. So I would say that the use of Hebrew in this form, I worked hard at to develop. I didn't really learn that from the outside, but as far as all the other composition and what makes good calligraphy in general, I had a solid calligraphic education for that.
And do you exhibit outside of Israel?
When I was studying in London, I had two exhibitions. My work has appeared a lot in calligraphic journals that appear internationally. And I haven't had an exhibition. I would love to be invited to exhibit somewhere.
Wonderful, Izzy. I mean, in addition to really, really enjoying your work, which we looked at now just before, understanding where it comes from is actually obviously secondary. But it's really been a pleasure, and I've enjoyed speaking with you. And I hope to see more of your work, and I trust that we will. Thank you very much, Izzy.
Thank you very much, Yara.